everybody. Hope you're ready for another journey through some classic Aussie pop. I'm Gavin Scott from pop music site chartbeats.com.au, and on board, as always, is Turn the Beat Around host Robbie Molinari from Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Hi, Robbie.
Hey, Gavin. It's good to see you after a big couple of weeks and two very popular Ricky Lee episodes. I want to send a big thanks to everybody for all their feedback. And of course, needless to say, there is a lot of love out there for Ricky Lee.
There sure is. And like that two-parter, which saw us venture into Australian Idol territory for the first time, in this episode, we're looking at a type of pop act we surprisingly haven't covered yet on the show.
That's right. In this episode, we are taking a musical journey with our very first boy band.
Yeah, now some people may class Indecent Obsession, who we covered in season one, as a boy band. But for me, while they were a band that had teen appeal due to their catchy songs and good looks, they were not a boy band in the new edition, New Kids on the Block sense. In this episode, we're talking to a classic 1990s boy band who came complete with vocal harmonies, formation dancing, and matching outfits.
You must be talking about CDB. The R&B vocal group were the complete package. They had the good looks, they could sing, they could dance, and they even wrote their own songs. Their biggest hit came in the form of a song called Let's Groove. Here's a little snippet to refresh your memory. Let's groove, get you to move. It's all right, all right, all right. Let us groove, light up the fuse, so stand up, all right, all right.
That was Let's Groove, a massive number two for CDB in 1995. And yes, that was a cover version, but we're going to be talking about a lot of songs that they wrote themselves. And there was a bit of a journey to the success of that first album and those singles like Let's Groove for Andrew De Silva, Danny Williams, and brothers Gary and Brad Pinto, the four members of the group. Say hi, guys.
Yeah, what's up, guys? I'm Andrew De Silva.
I'm Brad Pinto.
I'm Gary Pinto.
And I'm Danny Williams.
Now, the boys grew up in the southeastern suburbs of Melbourne and were in the final years of high school in the early 1990s when they decided to form a group. Bringing together their individual talents, they became CDB. That stands for Create, Dream, Believe.
I always thought CDB stood for something like Central Dandenong Boys, which is where they're from. But Robbie, you have the intel, don't you?
Well, it still could be that, you know, but I think in their later years, and you see that in the inlay of their second LP, Lifted, that it says it on the inside tray. It's got Create, Dream, Believe, which I guess is a good sum of what the guys do.
Indeed. Okay, let's hear properly from the guys now, who all joined us recently to chat about their music careers. We'll hear about those early days when they were getting together and what part Peter Andre played in them getting noticed. Here they are.
Collectively, you decided to form a vocal group. Who can tell us about how that started? Gary, I'll throw that one out to you.
Sure. So Brad, Danny and I had grown up together. Our parents were in a band together in India, and we sort of grew up together from 7 and 8 years old, you know, going to all the parties and things like that. And we started singing when we were about or doing dance routines in nightclubs and dance competitions and things like that throughout Melbourne and then sometimes in Queensland and different places and winning these kind of dance competitions through the R&B, New Jack Swing kind of style. And then we joined a company called Midnight, and Andrew was in this group. Andrew was this like incredibly gifted songwriter that we would see in this group called Visions of Youth that were just amazing. We were going to gigs and watching him play, and we thought, you know, that it's just an incredibly gifted 16-year-old kid playing keys and singing. And we had the dancing down and the singing down, but we didn't have any songwriting at the time, you know, so we were sort of, Andrew was sort of working out where he wanted to go. And one day we just said, you know, why don't you try and get together and let's see if we can make something come of this. We started doing shows together. And I think one of the first gigs we did was we had auditioned for a band or something. And one of the bass players saw us in a club and he goes, you're singers, right? Can you come and sing with Peter Andre background vocals for the Steve Izard show? So Andy and I, you know, packed up our stuff and sang the next night on the Steve Izard show. And sort of warmed Peter up and did all this kind of, you know, R&B scales. And he goes, can you bring the rest of your boys to the studio and see if we can record? I'm recording an album. So Danny and Brad, you know, they're in year 11 and we're in year 12, I think, Andy, at the time.
Yeah.
We went to, you know, Metropolis in the South Melbourne, started recording with Peter the whole first album. And Molly was there. And every night, you know, we had a ball. Peter's such a kind and beautiful fella. We just got along like brothers, all of us. And at that time, he got offered the Madonna tour. So, you know, Peter goes, I want to take these guys on tour with me. So we were young kids, just did the album with him, freaking jumped on a Madonna tour. And at the time we were, shopping a record deal around and playing our originals, and Sony was interested and Warner's was interested and all different companies were, and Mushroom was interested, but no one really bit, you know. We did the showcase and they said, you know, it doesn't feel like R&B is ready and you guys, we're not sure about you guys. And
what kind of group did you want to be? I mean, you knew it was R&B. Were you obviously influenced by the American sound, which was pretty still underground in Australia?
Totally. Well, Andy, what do you reckon? Like Troop?
There were vocal groups and, there were R&B groups that were like, we used to listen to the R&B groups for the production as well. Like there's a group called Guy who was really all about their production and their songs. And then there were the vocal groups like Boyz II Men and New Edition and the dancing. So it was very underground in Australia, but for us, it was life. It was everything, you know, like our little scene was, that's all we knew, you know, like all the nightclubs and all the DJs and the fashion. The only hard thing was, you know, if we went to Brash's, none of it was there. We had to go to a import shop and
Central Station.
But, you know, it still felt like that was our world. So definitely influenced by the R&B sound in America. The New Jack Swing, especially New Jack Swing.
That's all we listened to. That's all we did. That's all we followed. And yeah, it was a hard road at the start, even in 95 to from that live show perspective, because they didn't have the venues. They didn't have the space. They didn't have the marketing and stuff on the radio as well for it. We were just doing our thing. And it was nice that some of the tracks from overseas started getting traction here in Australia as well. So.
And it wasn't like, because like Danny's saying, we were so into it, it wasn't like we were watching them on the ARIA charts. On Saturdays, we'd go to the Chevron Underage and that's all they'd play. So that's all we knew.
We loved it. We lived it. from 91, that was our pocket money. None of us had real jobs. We would go and find, talent competitions that were being run somewhere and we'd enter them and we'd win them. And that was our pocket money, you know. And then the crowds just started getting bigger and then we got signed and was like, oh, my goodness, you know. It's just this progression.
So you were still in high school and you were doing this gig with Peter Andre.
Yeah, so we went on tour. It was the Madonna tour. Man, it was huge. That was our first ever taste of a going away on tour. And back then the budget's really big as well. So I still remember the hotel room had chandeliers hanging and everything. I was like, yep, this is what we're going to do. This is a good job.
Did any of you get to meet Madonna?
Very briefly ran into her backstage. They wouldn't let anyone go anywhere near her, and I knew when she would come off stage, but I was like, I'm going to go meet her, and I ran into her very briefly.
Well done, Danny.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Sony, they threw their hat in the ring in terms of offering you a record deal, and what was Sony like? Did the label get CDB, and did they understand what kind of group you guys wanted to be?
I think they got it.
I think they pretty much did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, there was always a little bit of, you know, weird stuff with the artworks.
Especially with the first album.
Sometimes we had to just, you know, direct them a little bit with the video clips, but they were getting on board pretty fast.
In all honesty, like when we first got signed, when we were about to get signed, we were supporting Rex and Effect, who was an offshoot of Guy. So Teddy Riley had a Rex and Effect, Eddie Rumpa Shaker. So we were in at the Metro playing, and Sony sent out maybe five or six girls from the office. So for 9 months, they were looking at us, or 6 to 9 months, they were looking. And they sent the five girls and they go, tell us if they are marketable and they're good looking enough to be. That's what it was. So the five girls from Sony came. Yeah.
What? I never heard this.
And went back and they go, yeah. And they go, so Andriana, all of the girls from the A&R and marketing went back and reported, yeah, they're good looking. They got a good sound. They knew about our sound, but are they marketable? Yes, they are marketable. Because we're three from Indian descent, one from Sri Lankan descent. They didn't know what this was.
It was different back then as well. I mean, it was very, very early in the scene with R&B music, dance music as well at the time. It was all, you know, it was still the rock and roll pub circuit. I remember, you know, our first record launch was at the ESPY, and we were working with a guy and he said, oh, you've got to do your record launch at the ESPY. And we're like, really? That was the done thing back then, but it so didn't fit our image or anything like that. So it was unique at the time. You know, we were playing all these pubs and not really set up for what we do, which is very much a show, not just, you know, a band.
Andrew, how did you find the Australian music industry react to, you know, to R&B?
They were fascinated, I think, as well. The thing with CDB was we managed to cross the pop R&B thing. So I think that really helped us as well. Just, you know, crossover to radio. It had that R&B sound, but it still had a pop kind of up-tempo feel about it as well. Looking back on it, I can tell that, you know, we were shaking some ground. Even the Hey Hey performances, you know, just seeing Daryl Summers hold up the CD and, you know, you can tell he was like, oh, there's something different, you know, singing live with their mouths.
Yeah.
I think back then there was a big thing about, which is not a big thing anymore, but it was a big thing about miming. Very big thing going on. Like some groups mimed, but they were fascinated that we never mimed.
What do you think made Sony change their mind in the end and they signed the deal? Brad, I'll throw that one out to you.
I think we had the songs. Andy brought all these songs and there were some certified hits. They were big songs, you know. So we had the package. What else do they need to spend? They've got to spend money on a film clip, traveling us around. There are four of us, not one solo, but they had the songs. They had a lot already in the can that they didn't have to invest in.
Out of those songs, were any of them the tracks that made it onto the album, the singles or such?
90% of them. Andy wrote 90% of the stuff. Like Let's Groove was a cover because they wanted the safety of that. Or Sony always want at the time. Even the Fugees, they made it do a cover. Any act on Sony at the time were doing one cover. So that was the cover we did. But 90% of the songs Andy had written in the bag. Then after that, Brad started writing, Danny started writing, we all started writing. But Andy was 16 at the time. Writing freaking Hook Me Up, Hey Girl, these are complex songs, like, and it's it was a prodigy, you know, like a child prodigy.
With a record deal with Sony Music, the most major of the major labels in place, CDB got to work on their music, and they were teamed up with some guys who knew a thing or two about R&B and pop.
Absolutely. The boys teamed up with former Wawani frontman Paul Gray and Sydney-based soul and dance music band The Rockmelons. Now together they penned what would become CDB's debut single. With the Rockies also producing the track, the end result was the R&B masterpiece that is Hook Me Up.
Me Up was released in October 1994 and gave CDB their first hit, peaking at number 11, agonizingly close to the top 10. This will always be my favorite CDB song. It was the perfect balance of American R&B sounds and shiny pop, with a hook that showed what raw talent Andrew De Silva had.
And at such a tender age. Let's hear from the guys now about Hook Me Up becoming their first hit.
Peter Carpenter over at Sony was in charge of our A&R. And I think we had all of the songs and they loved Andy's stuff, but they wanted that Rockmelon sound. And I know that Gary, Andy, Brad, we also liked that sound. So when we got a chance at working with Brian and the Rockmelons, it was amazing. And, you know, they were engaged to do the singles, really. I'll hand over to Andy because he was the one that was working most closely with them with the production. So go ahead.
Working with the Rockmelons was just, you know, such an education. They were in the forefront of R&B back in the 80s here, you know, using all the synths and the Lin drums. And they went to America as well. You could tell they went there, they researched what R&B and funk really is. We just learned so much. And back then too, it was a lot harder to make a song. You had to learn a lot of equipment. You know, these days you can do it on a laptop, you know. But back then I could tell, okay, this is a mixing desk and all the MIDI and stuff had to all line up. And just, you know, the finishing touches of production was such a fine art. So yeah, we learned a lot from the Rockmelons and Vince Del Tito and Anthony Dale. They're just amazing producers.
Did you think that the Rockmelons were the right fit for CDB and achieving the sound that you wanted to make?
Yeah, they definitely, well, in this country, they were the best to go to because they certainly knew how to get that polished R&B clean sound, you know, and they really, songwriting as well, they really had that ear for a hit. They did some things with my song that I was so shocked. I couldn't believe, but they chopped my middle eight or my pre-chorus in half. And it just sounded like someone chopped off an arm. Like, what? There? You're going to chop? Yeah, Andy, we're just going to chop it right there, mate. Just trust us. It doesn't need that other bit. It doesn't even rhyme, really. Just chop it there. And, you know, you just learn about all these things that, that's experience, you know what I mean? We're 17, 8 years old, you know, so we just learn so much.
And they can hear the hooks when they were producing like Gary's vocal and Andy's vocal. Like Brad and I would sit there when they were doing the vocal tracks when they were getting all the runs. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, that's Trousers. That's it. That's the one. You know?
Trousers.
There it is. And we're like, what? There it is. And they just hear the hook straight away. That's it. Take done.
Was Hook Me Up always going to be the first single?
Man, that's a great question. I can't remember.
Nah, there was never any. I remember. The only part I'd like to add is Peter Andre wanted to take it.
Oh,
really?
You don't remember? He wanted that before we released it, before we were signed properly.
Now, we had that demo, and on that demo was Hook Me Up. So that was the demo that we shopped around, and I think that everyone, they liked that track.
Brad, how did it feel for that debut single to take off and just go kaboom?
Oh, it felt amazing, man. It felt amazing because I think at the time, this is back in the era of in-stores. So you'd go to Chadston, Eastland, or all these massive shopping centres, and there was no internet, there was no mobile phones. It was all word of mouth or stickers on cars. And our old manager, Roger Abu, he was a hustler. Like he would go out and he would make sure these people knew about it through schools. He was just good at getting people together. So people just heard about it and would talk to one another, word of mouth, word of mouth. They'd get to these in-stores. You'd sell, I don't know how many hundred copies of a record. And that's what boosts you straight away onto the chart.
Hmm.
And we worked hard.
We worked pretty hard. We worked hard. Like, you know, we went around. I think even now, I think you probably find more signed copies of our album than you'll find unsigned ones.
I think in the first year and a half, I think we had, I could count on one hand or maybe one and a half, how many days off we had. Literally one hand. We were hammered. And we'd go from Australia to Asia. We'd just be nonstop. And as soon as we finished the gig, we'd go back from tour straight to the studio, from the studio to a later gig. Then go on tour with somebody, and then from the back of the Desiree show, we'd run into another club. Then we'd go from the club back to... It was just nonstop.
CDB wasted no time moving on to their second single with Hey Girl, in brackets, This Is Our Time, released in March 1995. This time around, the boys showed a different side. This was the era of boy band ballads like End of the Road, I Swear, If I Ever Fall in Love, and so on. So it made sense for CDB to also slow the tempo down.
I love that 60s doo-wop vocal arrangement on this track. That's what makes it for me. Again, written by a young Andrew De Silva and polished up with a little help from Paul Gray again and the fellas from the Rock Melons.
The result, another top 15 hit, with Hey Girl reaching number 14. The guys are going to talk about the song now.
Who decided that Hey Girl was going to be the next single?
Yeah, I think it was A&R, Peter Carpen. He was awesome. He was a real song man, real old school song man. Just loved hits, you know. He just, I was really honoured that he would listen to our stuff and just hear something in the songs, you know. Because, I mean, Hey Girl was just a song that I wrote, you know, for a girlfriend at the time when I was 16, had no idea that it was ever going to do anything. So these are just all just, you know, just a teenager writing some songs for fun. So it's amazing that he had the belief in us.
And you worked with Paul Gray from Wawanee as well on a couple of tracks, and he co-wrote Hey Girl. What element did he bring to the track?
Yeah. So Paul was a great arranger. He would take my dinky chords that I'd written, you know, I'd written the song, but someone like him would just make the song sound like $1 million, you know what I mean? Just the way he plays and the way also they, you know, change the structure of the song as well. They all love to cut stuff out because it's too long. But yeah, when listening to Paul in the studio, you know, on his keyboards on the Rhodes, mind-blowing. Beautiful player.
Ooh.
And very soulful as well. You know, they really matched us with Australia's R&B dudes. You know, these were the guys that were doing it back then. Man, I was listening to his stuff when I was in primary school, you know. Keytar, he had it down.
100%, 100%.
So, Robbie, things had been going pretty well for CDB up until this point. Any reservations Sony may have previously had about the group earlier in the decade were wiped away by two back-to-back hits. But what they were missing was a real monster single, weren't they?
Correct. CDB needed a track that would cross the generations of music lovers and get them closer to the top end of the charts. The answer was a cover version. With a lot of push from Sony, the boys recorded a remake of the Earth, Wind & Fire song Let's Groove. Let's have a quick listen to the original now.
The original of Let's Groove by Earth, Wind & Fire, which had reached number 15 in Australia in 1982 and got to number 3 in both the US and the UK and been a big hit around the world. It was the perfect song for CDB to cover, and they could update it in a way that matched their sound but didn't take it too far away from the original. And that original had been a hit long enough ago that many of CDB's younger fans wouldn't be familiar with it at all, so for them it would have been a new song as well.
Absolutely. And look, I love a good cover version, and this was on point. I'm also very happy for the guys because their version of Let's Groove eclipsed the success of the original here in Australia by getting to number 2. This was a huge track and instantly took CDB into the big league. Everybody knew this song back in 1995.
Well, they sure did, and it didn't just get to number 2, it stayed there. And stayed there. It spent 6 non-consecutive weeks in the runner-up position, stuck behind Gangster's Paradise by Coolio featuring LV, and it also spent another 5 weeks at number 3 during its chart run. It was the party song of the summer of 95-96, but how did the guys feel about doing a cover? Let's find out, and they'll also reveal an interesting bit of info about being blocked from number 1 by Coolio.
Now, you mentioned Sony were probably a little bit influential in telling you guys to record a cover version. Did they give you a couple of options, or did you, who came up with the idea to do Let's Groove, which was a stroke of genius?
Andrew De Silva. That was you, wasn't it, brother?
No. Well, if you're going to be very honest, it was Peter Carpen's idea. I was in the studio at the time, and my manager said, "Hey, man, listen, they want you to just demo Let's Groove." I go, "What? Let's Groove? Earth, Wind & Fire's Let's Groove? Okay, but everyone's going to know that's a cover." "Yeah, I know, mate, just do it. Just whack it down, send it back to them." So we quickly recorded the song in like, well, done the demo in like a couple of hours, just thinking, "Ah, there you go." And it was like, "Yep, beautiful, well done, boys." We never knew that it would work.
Gary, what did you think of covering Let's Groove?
I remember it a little differently, but they were wanting us really to do this song. "Whenever you want me, I'll be there." For ages, they kept saying, "Do this song, I'll be there, I'll be around. You just got to do this song."
Spinners.
Yeah, the Spinners. For months, we were like, "We're not doing that. Don't like it." And they're just really getting really kind of pushy on it. And then one day we were together and we went, "What's that song? Let's do that instead." So that's how I remember it.
Oh, wow.
We were so kind of fed up with that, "I'll be there." But it was the song. They said, "This is the song. You have to do it if you don't." So somewhere along the line, when we did it, when they jumped on it so fast, as Andy said, the demo went to Sony, and then they were like, "That's your single," and everything started. When Sony's machine starts and that freaking truck is pushing you and it's all systems go, it is amazing. And that's what happened with us. Let's Groove went, and this whole force just went behind us.
Yeah, I remember the first time that we were recording that album just off Lygon Street in Carlton. We were recording our first album there. And we used to go up and get pizzas for dinner. And as we were walking up to Lygon Street, every car was doing laps in Lygon Street and they were cranking Let's Groove. And I was like, "Oh my God, this is going to be huge." They're like, "Boys, look at this.
Oh my God."
I mean, that was the moment I was like, "All right, this is going to be big."
It was big. Did you love the song after that?
Yeah, I mean, we still play it. You know what I mean? It's still one of those songs that at the end of the party, here we go, you know. It's a great song. It's just such a happy bass line, even the bass line alone. You know, it's kind of dinky, but it's so happy and chirpy, but it's still with the vocoder and the fatness of Earth, Wind & Fire on top of it. It's still a real cool song. But if you listen to the songwriting, "Gonna tell you what you can do with my love." You know, they really go, "You know what? Let's just write a happy pop song," you know.
Were you chart watchers? Would you look at where the singles were going in at the charts and sort of how they were rising and sort of whether they were stalling anywhere? I mean, Let's Groove was held off the top spot by Gangster's Paradise.
Well, the funny thing, bro, about that situation was back in the day, Gangster's Paradise for 6 weeks, nobody knows this, but had lost their master in the States. They had lost the master that can only reprint. So for 6 weeks, they kept Gangster's Paradise at number 1 without having any sales in the world.
What?
Because they couldn't print it off the master. Yeah, we sat at number two, and I was waiting for it to go to number one because there was no stock. There was no physical stock anywhere in the world because they didn't have the master.
I was working in retail at the time, and we couldn't get the single in stock for weeks.
There you go.
And all we kept getting told was that it was sold out.
There it is.
A fourth single from CDB was released in early 1996. Don't Stop reached number 28, a respectable showing given that their debut album Glide With Me was out by this stage. Let's hear a bit of Don't Stop now.
Listening back to Don't Stop after several years, it has aged very well. I like that the boys went with something a little edgier in Don't Stop compared to their previous singles. They were obviously staying true to their R&B roots, but showing their fans, peers, and critics, we can bounce with the best of them, you know. As for the album, I mean, that landed just at the right time. It came a few weeks after the release of Let's Groove, so that was such a big single, everybody was able to get their hands on the album straight away. And as a result, that debuted in the top 10, went gold, and was a huge success for them. This was a really good effort for an Aussie R&B band and an Aussie boy band. I loved the LP.
Yeah, it was really great to see an Australian pop act do so well, but especially an R&B group, and that was a genre, as we heard at the start from the guys, that hadn't really been that well supported locally. And overseas R&B groups and singers had become more successful in Australia since Bobby Brown had broken through, and it took him long enough to cross over here. But there were very few Australian R&B acts having such commercial success, especially in the form of a top 10 smash album.
Let's go back to the boys in the band to hear about making Glide With Me. Single number four, Don't Stop. Were you guys concerned that it had only got to number 28 after Let's Groove had done so well?
Oh, I mean, that was our best film clip.
Hmm.
Probably the worst performing song, but it was the best film clip. It was one of our favourite songs too. I mean, we liked the song, but maybe we were biting a bit more off than the public was ready for.
I mean, that was definitely more of an R&B sound. That definitely had more of that American R&B sound, whereas Let's Groove was more pop.
Absolutely. It was always always in my little world, it was always a tug of war between doing something that you think is good versus what you know is going to sell. I think it's probably like that in every industry, really. you've got your pride. You know, you've got not pride, but you want to make good, what you think is good music, you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, and that's what a good A&R helps you with.
Glide With Me, the album that comes out just in time for Christmas, November of 1995, debuts in the top 10, goes gold. Are you happy with that accomplishment?
Oh, we were stoked. Man, yeah, we were stoked. It was unreal, you know, just to have an album, finished album. It was a lot of blood, sweat and tears went into that album as well, you know. Just an older equipment. It's like anything. Things took longer to record back then. And we were perfectionists. All of us were perfectionists. We took a long time.
You guys were on the road a lot as well. I mean, you started doing a lot of other support gigs. I remember seeing you support Tina Arena. Danny, who were some of the other people that you guys started supporting in the 90s? I mean, I heard you say Desiree before.
Yeah, that was one of our first gigs at the Basement in Sydney with Desiree. I think that was really good. I remember we did the Boyz II Men show here in Melbourne, and for me that was insane because that was Rod Laver. You know, that was where we went to go and see our idols play. And I remember that was on my birthday. Wow. And we'd done a massive tour out at High Point that day as well. So it was just massive. And then we came out on stage and did that. And it was, that for me, that was pretty big. But what else have we been with?
I think we did Shy with like one of the, who were the other R&B groups? Heaps of R&B groups. Rex and Effect, Silk as well.
Casey and JoJo.
Jodeci. We did Jodeci and what was that? Rap Brown.
Lotta Shadow Brown.
Montel Jordan.
Basically, you name it, we played everywhere. We sang on stages. We sang on the back of trucks. We sang at beaches. We sang in shopping centre car parks. We sang on floating pontoons in the middle of Sydney Harbour. You name it, we did it.
Did you enjoy the interviews and the press? What was it like for you guys being pop stars?
Yeah, I think it was just part of the life, isn't it? It was work, but it didn't feel like work. And I'm just glad that I had these boys with me. I think it would have been a very different experience if you were a solo artist. I think it'd be very, very different. But having someone to bounce things off and actually have fun with along the way, it was good.
Okay, things had gone well for CDB with their first album and the associated singles, but instead of carrying on with new music straight away, it was well over a year before the lead single of what would be their second album, Lifted, was released. But despite the delay, Good Times sounded like another smash.
I thought this was such a great track back at the time, and it hasn't lost its touch at all. It's one of those party anthems with simple, literal lyrics that works perfectly and does not sound cheesy or cliche. Personally, I can hear a lot of inspiration from Montel Jordan in the sound of Good Times, who had had one of the biggest songs in the world in 1995 with This Is How We Do It. Good Times became a top 40 hit single, peaking at number 28 in 1996, matching the exact same chart position of their last single, Don't Stop, 18 months prior. Now, I guess number 28 for a fourth single from an album that was already out is okay, but when Good Times was a brand new song from an as yet unreleased album, a number 28 peak was a bit disappointing, more so because the song was so good, and even more so because it's my favourite CDB song.
Well, especially in that case, it should have done better. I was surprised because, yeah, it's a great song and CDB were back. So let's hear about Good Times and why it may not have performed as well as, well, you and I and many other people would have hoped.
Did you expect it to do a little bit better? I did.
Yeah, I did. I did. I did. I still think it's a banger.
I think it partly had to do with the 2.5 year break. It was starting to get to that place where people would ask us, what's the difference between you and the Backstreet Boys? And we're like, what the heck? Have you not heard our music? Or you and Take That. And we're getting so fast at producing stuff that we, for 2.5 years, we had let that boat sort of, and then we're trying to get on that boat. You know what I mean? Just too long a break, I think. All these guys, they do not let their fans go. We didn't. We took the time to make the record and just got, not realizing that in the same time, the boat's departing.
Towards the end of 1997, a new single Back Then, which was co-written by the Pinto Brothers, and the album Lifted were released. Whereas 2 years earlier, CDB had been unshakable from the top 10, both these releases peaked in the 40s.
Let's hear from the guys about Back Then and the Lifted album.
Do you remember when life seemed so simple then, that summer in the park? Back when it was the perfect time for love.
Brad, back then, how was that for you to get your song released as a single?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was amazing. And like the Rockies again made it, the sound of it, like they just brought it to another level. And then Tommy Emmanuel said he'll play on it. And we were like, wow, yes, please. Thank you. Thank you for that. And he literally came to the studio, did two takes and walked out.
I think for the second album, we all started kind of writing a bit more. We'd been on the road and we're sort of picking up guitars and we've all sort of done that our whole lives. We never as kids sort of delved into it as much as Andy did as a kid. So we started writing more. Brad wrote his first song. He played guitar in the meanwhile and wrote Back Then as his first song. And it was like murderous. Like when we first heard it, Peter Carpin goes, he heard this melody and he goes, what is that? And they go, oh, that's Brad's first song that he wrote. He goes, that is a monster. That is a monster song. We have to have it on the album. There are periods where we were almost thinking, is this what we want to continue doing as a group? And someone like Tom Manuel come and talk to us and go, you guys are awesome what you do. It's inspiring watching you. And it would give us another boost. So it was a real a time of reconstruction of the group. And the sound started sort of developing, I think, and deepening.
Started to mature a little bit as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot more live stuff on the album as well, because we've been playing with the band and we've been touring with the band. And, so there was a lot, you'll hear a lot more live instruments and stuff on that second album.
Yeah, there's a couple of songs on that as well, like Lessons and Lay My Love on You. They're quite, you can hear us really maturing as well, with our lyrics and strong song structure and harmonies and all that kind of stuff. You can hear us growing up a bit.
Did you feel like Sony gave Lifted the same kind of push they'd given Glide With Me?
I don't feel that at all, yeah. Good question. I don't feel that. And at the time, we would see kind of the budget allocations. We'd know the budget allocations, but we'd feel it, with our other artists around us. And we'd go, those artists are very different to us, but yet they're pouring money into what they're doing and they're not even really opening the cupboards to us. So we kind of felt that neglect around the second album. And then I guess the real evidence of it was the second album, the launch of the second album, when we did it at this club in the Cross. And it was kind of, it felt like, okay, you're in a lower gear with the record company. Ray Medhurst used to say, when the record company's cupboards close and you don't get your free CDs when you leave, he goes, then you know where you are. And they said the worst form of it is at the time you would see on the tables, coasters. Some of the CDs were made coasters. He goes, if your CD is a coaster, you know where you're landing.
Thank God we never saw our own.
Why do you think that was from Sony?
Why the second album? I think
they didn't believe in it. I don't think they believed in it.
And you know what, brother? At the time, I look at the turnover of artists back in those days was massively, it was so fast. Artists would get signed and dropped so fast, and there was no kind of follow-on 2, 3, 4 albums of this kind of what we did. Whereas now, sometimes I see an artist like Guy Sebastian, he has got 10 albums on Sony or on a label, and he can constantly get the support. So it's quite a different landscape, I think, from when it was then.
At the same time as CDB's chart success began to falter a bit, the group was rocked by an unexpected setback of a very different kind.
Band member Andrew De Silva was diagnosed with the last thing any young man in his early 20s wants to be faced with, testicular cancer.
Yeah, it was a real shock for Andrew to have to deal with, and by extension, the band. Andrew's going to tell us now what happened and what it meant for his time in CDB.
Oh, that was just a real, that was shock. I think I was in my early 20s, like 24, testicular cancer. And I remember being in the ward and all these other guys my age, you know, like, what's going on? And apparently it's a common thing, you know, but we were doing the teen arena tour. And I just remember something wasn't right. So I just went to my GP next day. I was warned about it, but as you know, all young guys are, you know, thought I'll be fine. And I went back on tour. And that's why when I came back, they were like, we need to check this out. It doesn't look good. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that whole time in the hospital, I think just, it was a break I never asked for. But, you know, it definitely just to stop like that and to lie in a hospital bed was, full on.
How long were you away from the band for and not working? Did you actually ever go back?
I had to do a few rounds of chemo and that really kind of threw me around a bit. And I didn't know that I wanted to go back and perform ever again because I was such a studio guy then as well. I really loved being in the studio and I just thought, well, if I ever go back to music, I think I'm just going to write songs. But I was just so unsure. Like I knew my life was going to take another road. That's about all I knew. That's about all I could see. And everyone was really understanding. I mean, guys were beautiful about it. And even the record company, everyone really understood that, you know, I need to do something different or just take a break.
Danny, I'll ask you, how did it feel with Andrew being absent from the band?
It was definitely unusual. It was a massive gap. We didn't really know what was going on. I think at the time we all went to India as well. They were launching some stuff overseas for Sony. We were doing some work. Gary, Brad and myself were also overseas at the same time that this had happened. So then we came back and we didn't really know what was going on. So it was unique. We're trying to work out how to keep the show on the road, I suppose, at the same time. But we didn't really know what was going to happen. I don't think it was ever really the same. The four of us, I think, have got something quite unique. I don't think it's replaceable, especially Andy, like a big part of the band.
You had someone step in and fill the gap, Jude Nicholas. Where did you find Jude?
Yeah, we all used to sing together with Midnight Productions, which is a production company that we had with our old manager, Roger Abood, was his production company, and we were all part of it. So a lot of groups in Noble Park and Dandenong that were part of that. And Jude always had this amazing voice. You know, it's just this soulful, beautiful, beautiful voice in there. So I remember talking about it with Brad and Gary, and we were talking about, you know, what to do. I think we still had gigs and we had stuff that was going on too.
With replacement member Jude Nicholas taking Andrew's place, CDB continued to lift singles from Lifted. And in an attempt to emulate the success of their cover of Let's Groove, they issued their remake of the Daz Band's Let It Whip as their next single. Let's take a listen to the original and CDB's cover of Let It Whip now.
A minute of your time tonight. We both are here to have.
you've got to give credit where credit is due. You've got four great singers, the Rock Melons again on production duties, in theory, a great choice for a cover version, and I think Let It Whip was executed very well, and the result was very good. Unfortunately, the R&B cover version strategy didn't quite work this time.
Yeah, it didn't, did it? Let It Whip became CDB's first single to miss the top 50. Let's go back to the guys to hear their thoughts on them releasing this single.
Was that your idea, or was that the record company saying, hey, we need another cover, we want another Let's Groove?
Well, that was Sony going, if something doesn't happen, and we guarantee this is going top three. We guarantee it. And we're like, we do not want to do another cover. We're not a cover band. We're freaking original. We're writing our own songs. We're good at what we do. You need to do this or else, and it's going to go top three. And we got just peppered with it. Let it whip. So reluctantly, very reluctantly, we did it and released it, and it didn't go top three. The thing was, people that were saying it's going to go top three, I'll quit myself. I promise you it's going to go top three. I'll quit my job. Funny. And it was hard. You know, there's a lot of guys that were just ruthless, like another cover. What are you doing? You know, I mean, but it was a tough time for us because we felt like we were forced to do that at the time.
Why do you think Let It Whip didn't work? Why didn't it get to this estimated number three?
Yeah, I mean, Let's Groove is a monster. Let's Groove is a killer track. Let's Groove probably did better than Let It Whip, the original versions. I'm sure a lot more people know Let's Groove. Even if you don't know Let's Groove and you hear that for the first time, I still see the younger generation when they hear that song, they just rush to the dance floor. It's just such a great song. And also lyrically as well, Let It Whip. I mean, what does that mean to people? You know what I mean? It's a real funk song. I mean, real true funksters know that's a killer track in itself, but Let's Groove is just worldwide.
At the tail end of the 90s, there were a few more single releases, including two notable collaborations with some Aussie heavyweights. First up was a single with Tommy Emmanuel that was included on his 1998 album Collaboration. The song was another Earth, Wind & Fire cover, but this time the ballad After the Lover's Gone. Then in 1999, first there was one further and final single from the now two-year-old Lifted album called So Bad, and then the piece de resistance. Some genius decided to pair CDB with Australia's Queen of Soul, the late Renee Geyer. They perfectly complemented each other on a cover version of the song I'm Gonna Make You Love Me, a Motown track originally recorded by Dinah Ross and the Supremes with the Temptations in 1969. Let's take a listen to CDB and Renee's version, and then we'll go back to the guys to hear about a memorable moment with Renee.
Oh, this is a good one. I'm gonna make you love me. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. I'm gonna make you love me. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. Renee Geyer asked us to do a song with her, right? So... We did a song together, and one day we had the Hey Hey performance, and Renee had lost her voice, right? So this is she's never ever mimed in her life, and she goes, look, we're going to mime this gig because I lost my voice. And we go, we're definitely not miming. We go, you can mime, but we're to Renee. So she goes, okay, and she got so angry, but she goes, okay, I'll mime, but you sing live, whatever. We did the gig and we're singing live on air, and Renee forgot that she's miming. So she's ad-libbing like she's king. She's the monster. She's the best singer in the world. The camera's on her, but she's singing ad-libs and stuff as well as because she wasn't used to miming. So like, oh, she was so angry after the gig. She was like, you made me. God bless her. God rest her soul.
You might think that the end of the first era of CDB was a simple matter of dwindling sales and an eventual split, but that's not quite what happened. Let's let the guys explain.
She joined the group. Julian Lennon came out with Imogen Heap, and we started doing gigs with those guys, and it felt really good, you know? And we got offered a deal in London with 52 dates with Take That, Boyzone, Backstreet Boys, all these guys. And at the time, Jude and his girlfriend got pregnant. So for us... We had Andrew had left maybe a year before. Jude had joined the group 6 months earlier. It was all going to start again. And he goes, no, it's all right. We'll move to London. I go, the three of us said, we can't, you can't. You're going to have a baby. You can't uproot your life. We're supposed to live in London for 2 years. We've got to re-record the second album and go on tour. That's it for us, you know. Looking back, we could have probably, you know, done the tour with Jude or gone on three or rejigged it all, but we sort of were so tired of sort of starting and stopping and starting and stopping. At 23, we're 23 and 22 or whatever it was, we just threw it in at that point.
I remember exactly where we were when he told us. We're at the Hotel New Hampshire and he was sitting on the couch. And when he said it, I thought he's full, he can't be serious. I could not believe. I remember his exact angle, exactly where I was standing. And I thought, he's joking. I thought, this guy's got to be joking. But I said, congratulations. What do you do? How far out?
So with CDB having gone their separate ways, in the first half of the 2000s, both Gary and Andrew released solo singles, What the Day Brings and Just Like Good Music, respectively, with limited chart success. Let's hear those two now.
After CDB broke up, after Jude left, we disbanded, then Sony, Brad and I started writing for my record. We just started writing songs over 9 or 10 months with our guitarist. And then Sony offered a deal again under another company. Paul Dainty and James Packer had a label. So they paid for Brad and I to go to New York and LA and record this killer album. We made it. They spent a lot of money, came back to Australia, and they folded the company. And it's virtually parallel to what Andy was doing. Andy was smashing a record, his own solo project under Sony as well, at the same time.
Neither of those albums made it out, did they?
Yeah, I think for me, I was getting into that real kind of, I wouldn't say rock, but just more earthy, you know. It's sort of a mix between Rafael Sadiq, Lenny Kravitz, and because, you know, I started on the guitar as well as a teenager, so I went back to playing guitar. And I think after I was sick, it was very simple for me. I couldn't write songs about the dance floor, and the songs became a lot deeper. And I think if I had just released my music on my own, but no one was doing this stuff back then, you know, if I just put my own music out, it would have worked so well. But I get it. The record company just wanted me to be Craig David. And now I get it. Now I get it. Oh, yeah. Andy, CDB. Yeah, Craig David. I love Craig David. Don't get me wrong. Craig David's he's a beast of a singer, but I get it. I had the acoustic guitar, so they thought, Craig David, but I just, nah. And I was very headstrong then, very headstrong. No one could tell me nothing. I don't care what you say. And I didn't care about being successful. You know, I didn't care. I just wanted to do good music, and that's what I did.
And Danny, what about you? What did you get up to after the band split?
Oh, I decided to take a bit of a break from music, and I've been in this this band and this machine for so long. I wanted to, you know, something that was bigger than myself for so long. I wanted to just go and do something myself. I went over to England and I worked over there for a little bit, and I came back and started working in travel and sales and doing a whole bunch of other stuff. So I'm still doing that.
And did you enjoy taking a step right out of the music industry?
I think I needed to at the time, yeah, absolutely. And it was nice doing something for myself, I think.
In the mid-noughties, the four original members of CDB regrouped and began work on a new album. The concept was a covers album made up of R&B and funk songs predominantly from the 80s. Now, this is something I would have lapped up like a little kitten drinking milk. Unfortunately, the album never saw the light of day. We did, however, get one new single from them, a cover of the Michael Jackson song PYT, Pretty Young Thing.
Let's hear a bit of PYT and let's hear the story behind that album.
PYT, oh man, one of our all-time favorite songs off the Thriller album.
It was like literally it got released maybe two weeks before his passing, before Michael's passing. So when it got released and he passed, everyone was like, the people around us, the record company were keen to push it. We didn't want to push it because we felt it was disrespectful, to be honest. It's Michael Jackson's life. We're not pushing anything.
And there was an album supposedly coming out around the same time called The Funk Session. What happened to that?
What did happen to that, boys? It's a killer album.
It's a good album still.
I think I sort of remember what happened, and correct me if I'm wrong. I think the record company at the time was just, I just think it wasn't making clear sense. The whole funk concept just wasn't, it's not like Motown, it's not like soul, it's like funk, and you know what I mean? It just quite didn't, in Australia as well, what history here do we have of funk? You know, how many people know funk, you know? Whereas My Girl and...
Was it just cover versions on that LP?
Yeah, Get Down On It.
Fantastic Voyage.
That Chic song.
Good Times.
Good Times.
There's an Isley Brothers song there too, a beautiful Isley Brothers song. It's Your Thing and...
Who's That Lady?
Who's That Lady?
Word Up.
Word Up, yeah, cameo.
Peter Carpen, I work with Peter Carpen still on The Voice. He's A&Ring for The Voice. He still talks about that album and he says, I'm still going to get it back from Universal for you guys. He just about a week ago, he says, if you guys want to work it, I'll get that back from Universal for you.
It would take a further 10 years for CDB to eventually release a third album. Tailored For Now landed in April of 2017. It was a collection of 11 R&B cover versions, including songs like Every Little Step, End of the Road, and This Is How We Do It. And the best part, 9 tracks on the album were produced by Andrew and 2 tracks by Gary. What brought you guys back together at this point?
It's all about, you know, perfect timing. It just felt... That whole R&B. I think we did a gig with Salt and Pepper. That was it.
Yeah.
Am I right, boys? Yeah, we did a gig with Salt and Pepper. And what an eye-opener for that. We did it was a double bill with them. And we sat back and watched them. And they were just doing, besides doing all their hits, they were doing the hits of that time. And the penny just dropped. We're like, man, we just got to do a show like this. We could do all our songs, but we can do Boyz II Men. We can do, and it was just the thing, you know, suddenly 90s R&B, all of a sudden became cool again. Because early 2000s, no one talked about it. I don't want to hear about any R&B from the 90s. It was like, ugh, yuck.
What's the status of CDB these days?
For us as a band, we'll always have... So for Brad's wedding, for example, we haven't seen each other for years. We hadn't, you know, I hadn't seen Andy for years. Danny occasionally saw. And then people said, you know, get to sing something for Brad's wedding. And literally every harmony... Every freaking phrase was exactly as it was because we used to practice 5 days a week for like four or five years at Andy's house. So we know, even now, if we do a gig together, I know exactly where Andy is. I know where Brad is, where Danny's on the stage without even looking. So this group will always have, you know, if something comes up, someone's offered us something recently that we can't talk about yet, but a double bill of some sort next year. It's nothing for us to just go... A week of rehearsals, bang straight back in, and it feels like it's great. We'll always have love for each other. We're brothers. So it's the musical bond as well as our family bonds are just beautiful. So I don't think this group will ever die. It'll have life in it always.
And away from these occasional CDB reunions, Andrew won season 6 of Australia's Got Talent in 2012, no biggie, and the Pintos have remained heavily involved in the music industry with Gary releasing a Sam Cooke tribute album last year. Oh, Robbie, I'm glad to have been able to share the CDB story. I distinctly remember in 1994, that debut with Hook Me Up. I was quite into pop R&B at the time, and I just thought it was great that we had an Australian vocal harmony group delivering a single that held its own against the best American R&B groups. And without trying to just copy what was being done overseas, it felt like its own thing. You know, it wasn't just like, let's try and do what they're doing. But it's a shame that the burst of success on that first album wasn't able to be sustained because the guys have some serious talent.
And the fact that a few of the guys continue to successfully work in the industry is testament to their talent. You know, on top of that, they are 4 of the humblest guys you could ever meet. And I do want to add that after having lived in the UK for a decade and absorbing the music culture over there, I really think that a band like CDB with their Indian and Sri Lankan heritage would have absolutely smashed it over there. You know, they were leagues, in my opinion, ahead of counterpart bands like Blue or Another Level who were having number one singles over there. Just saying. But I agree with you, Gavin. It's been really, really great to hear their story.
You can hear more from the 4 guys from CDB in the full interview in the bonus material. We asked them how they compared themselves to the likes of Culture and Past to Present. So it's interesting to hear what they say about that and a few other bits that we didn't have time to fit in this episode. Head to chartbeats.com.au/Aussie for the bonus material for this episode and every episode in the 2 seasons of A Journey Through Aussie Pop so far. Our next episode, we're going to hear from this lady.
Hi, I'm Kate Sobrano, and I'm talking to Chartbeats about my journey through pop.
Yes, finally, Kate Sobrano joins A Journey Through Aussie Pop. Robbie, we're going to have a lot to say about her extensive body of work, aren't we?
Absolutely. Can't wait to get into it.
All right, we'll see you in a couple of weeks for that one. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye now.